You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
I collected 30 students. We armed ourselves with Molotov cocktails. Hijacked a bus, asked him to go to Tallinn, and then we were on the barricades by the radio station.
This is Cold War Conversations.
Thanks to Patreon John O'Connor for our intro today. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app, so you don't miss out on future episodes. In 1985, an 18-year-old Estonian named Riho Terras arrived at the Soviet Armed Forces Large Conscript Assessment Facility in Tallinn, obeying his conscription orders. Little did he know that 26 years later, he would be a NATO general. Riho shares his experiences in the Soviet Navy with us in some detail. We hear about his service on the Soviet frigate Zadorny, including trips to the Mediterranean and Cuba, as well as monitoring NATO warships. Riho also shares his experiences of Estonian independence and the challenges of converting the country into an independent nation. I'm extremely grateful to Elizabeth Brawer, a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, who facilitated this interview via her Engelbert Ideas essay. Thanks to all of you for listening to the podcast. It is an absolute passion for me to save these stories from being forgotten and sharing them weekly for free for everybody to hear. And whilst this is a passion, I'm asking if each listener could make either a one-off or better still, sign up to a small monthly donation to help me find the time to produce and finance the project. If you'd like to know more, just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate. If a financial contribution is not your cup of tea, then you can still help us by leaving written reviews wherever you listen to us, as well as sharing us on social media. It really helps us get new guests on the show. So, back to the episode. I'm delighted to welcome Riho Terras to our Cold War conversation.
I was born in Estonia, in northeast of Estonia, in a little town called Jõhvi, and that was 1967.
And what did your parents do for employment?
My father was a worker in the dairy factory, and my mother did budgeting and finances whole life.
Were your parents nationalists in terms of, were they in favor of an independent Estonia?
Yeah, of course. I was born in the region where there were only 8% Estonians. So it was a pretty challenging life from as long as I remember, because of the street fights with Russian-speaking boys. And I never had a single friend who was Russian. And my parents were from the family of farmers, and some of their family members were deported to Siberia. Some of them were executed in 1941. So it was not publicly discussed that much. The mentality was pretty anti-Soviet. Yes.
What sort of accommodation did you live in? Were you in flats?
Yeah, in this block flats, like everywhere that these times. Well, perhaps there's an interesting fact that I joined underground resistance movement, blue, black and white, in the age of 13. That was 1980 during the Olympic Games in Moscow and Tallinn. We had a organization in Tallinn, Pärnu, and in my region as well, where children were, we were copying the Declaration of Independence of 1918 and posting it in the mailboxes of people and stealing red flags. That was the kind of operation we did.
So very, from a very early age, you were trying to resist the Soviets then?
Yes.
What were your neighbors like? You said they were mainly Russian, were they?
All. In my house, which had 150 flats, I think, there were two families of Estonians.
Wow. Wow. And how would you describe your childhood?
Happy, as always. If you look back, the childhood is always happy. But what I remember is that you were never able to be sure going out that you will not be beaten up by the Russians just because you are Estonian.
So there was always this fear.
Yeah, and kind of a will to resist to it. But there were always more. So that was the problem. So we tried always to move in groups, that you would not stay alone somewhere in this area where I was living the whole first 18 years, actually.
Did you have any relatives in the West at all or not?
No, I didn't. But I had some friends who had some relatives living in UK or in the States. But me, I didn't have any. They were all executed or died in Siberia at that time.
Did your mother and father tell you to not tell people outside the family circle about the independence movement or anything like that?
Well, I didn't tell my family. My father experienced it only after the regaining independence. I showed him some papers, some letters, etc. I didn't tell them. And they didn't discuss the topic at home. But on the other hand, my father always had in his cardboard, blue, black, and white books and things, and I was reading them secretly. So it was kind of not the topic, actually. But he was listening all the time, Radio Free Europe and West of America. So in their age of kind of 13, 14, he started to allow me to listen to it as well. So this Estonian programs, which were broadcasted in Radio Free Europe and in Voice of America.
Was the language banned at that time, or were you allowed to speak the language?
No, it wasn't. No, it wasn't. Well, I went to Estonian school. I had all my schoolmates and friends were Estonians, and we didn't really have any problems with that. And the language in the streets and everywhere was both bilingual, so no problem to speak Estonian. Of course, I learned very, very early stage Russian because of the environment I was living, but no. And in the rest of Estonia, Russian language was almost not used. So my wife, for example, she's 50, she doesn't speak Russian.
What did you do during your spare time when you weren't at school?
Sports, art, what young people do.
And
stupid things also. But
I'm sure.
Well, nothing very special.
Did you have to serve in the Young Pioneers?
Yeah, and the Young Communist League, and all the class. I mean, I was even not asked whether I want or not. They brought me a paper, and then I was a member.
And were you fed a lot of propaganda at school? Was that part of the education?
Yeah, of course. I mean, there's all the time you had all the communist rubbish coming from all. But nobody really believed it. I mean, at least Estonians. I mean, I don't know what the Russians thought or didn't. But the Estonians never really believed in that. That was kind of a evil thing you had to accept, but nobody really, really believed full-heartedly on that system.
What was your reaction to receiving the letter that you were being called up for military service?
Well, that time the system was that you had to, if you went to the university, then you didn't have to go to the service, or you had to go later, or well, kind of. But I missed the exams, so I didn't succeed with the exams. And so I was working on the agriculture that time. Then I received a letter, and that was okay. I mean, everybody went there. There was no discussion, actually, not to go. I know that in Tallinn and some very well-educated schools, or very popular schools, or very so public type of schools, there were boys who tried to fake, or who had parents giving them kind of medical doctors' papers not to go, or they had a plan to go somewhere better, some better organized military structures close to home. But I didn't have any kind of a network, so I just received my papers and was planned to be to go to the Marines, at least in the first papers.
Because I guess the fear at that time is that you'd be serving in Afghanistan.
Well, the fear was not obvious until the moment I received the letter, because the system was that Russian conscription drafted with the order of the Minister of Defense, which came out end of September, twice a year, end of September and end of March. And from the period of, say, like 25th of September to the 31st of December, we were drafted in this 3 months period. And then, of course, the first drafts, the first ones to go, were to go abroad or more important positions. DDR, Hungary, Marines, Navy, and, of course, Afghanistan, which was the same as you go to DDR, as they called it, Voyen Internationalist, or soldier internationalist, or you went to Afghanistan. That was the same draft, or Navy, or Marines. So I was drafted in as a Marine, but of course the fear was that something can go wrong somewhere in this system and you would land in Afghanistan. That moment there was a fear. I was not afraid of being drafted for 3 years, because that seemed to me impossible choice.
3 years is a long time at that age as well.
It is.
What was your first day like?
We were gathered in the little bus at night in Kohtla-Järve, the place where I was, and then I was brought to Tallinn, where you had the turnover point of all conscripts from all Estonia. And in this place, they called it Fee Market, where then the representatives of the military units all over Soviet Union came to take their conscripts to their bases, to their respective planned units. And there always something could go wrong. So we were gathered together. We had a big fight between Estonians and the Russians there as well during the day. And that night then they came, and I was picked up by black uniforms, which means Navy or Marines. And I really hope that now it is Marines, because Marines were 2 years, very elite unit. So because of my doing sports that time, I really hoped that I go to the special unit. But then I was brought together with some other Estonians like 10 of us, we were brought to Kaliningrad region on the train in civilian clothes, not in uniforms. I don't remember, but I think the place was called Pionersk. I don't know the German name or the other name of it. And there was another collection point where everybody then was brought to the units. And there, I think something went wrong, and I didn't go to the Marines. But then they said, we were sleeping in the middle of the night in the cold weather. I don't remember what, early October, but really rain and cold weather in the middle of the square. So we didn't have any dormitory. We were sleeping, we're standing there, everybody fell asleep together. And then we were picked up and said that you are going to Navy. 2 years and 12 months, as they announced. not 3 years, but 2 years and 12 months. That was the first time I experienced that I will go to the Navy. And then I was brought to Mamonovo, a little city on the border of Soviet Union and Poland. A formal Prussian barracks where I did spend 6 months. It was a school of the sea mine specialist.
What was that training like? I mean, I've heard that the junior conscripts were treated pretty badly, and there was problems with, well, bullying is probably not a strong enough word, but certainly they were not treated very well. What was your experience like?
I expected that question. For me, it was a very different, but it was kind of very often the case with Estonians. Then there, it was asked who can paint or who can draw drawings or who is an artist. And since I mentioned that I went to the art school during my school years, I of course volunteered to be an artist. And then that happened that the next 6 months I didn't participate in any of the lessons, but was an artist of the company. Which means official time I painted Lenin's and all these pictures of the different communists and painted black kind of propaganda items. And the rest of the time I was preparing special albums for the people who were leaving with nice pictures and photos and so kind of artworks for the older serving sergeants of the unit, conscripts of 3 years serving. So I had a very nice life. I didn't have to do anything. Was well fed, got parcels from home, and was not doing any single thing for the Navy that time.
But I think that changed, didn't it, Bria?
Yeah, well, and the point was, normally Estonians in different ends of the Soviet Union, they were drivers, musicians, artists, clerks.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Because if you could read and write and even understood certain things, you were already in advantage. But I felt that these 6 months of my preparation or 6 months was nice, but I couldn't imagine to stay there in this hole for 3 years. So I volunteered to go, not to stay there. They offered to be artist of the regiment, but I volunteered to go to the ship, to the Navy. And then I was sent to a place called Arakuba. It's near the Severomorsk, close to the Norwegian city Kirkenes, up over the polar crust, place where Kursk in the future, submarine Kursk, was at home. The closest village of officers' wives was 30, 40 kilometers away. And there were only six ships and three submarines in the base. That was the place where I landed then in spring 1986. So the first months were very a lot of light. The sun didn't go down at all. So it was very sunny. Lots of work on the ship because everything people did, there was no crews, no like people, civilians who were keeping their ship in order. You had to paint it, take the rust away, work all the time, cleaning everything. But we were happy that our ship then took off to a long voyage. Every, say, tenth of the ships went to this kind of a long trips abroad, and I was happy to be on the ship. Kriva class frigate, Project 1135, with 100 people on board. We went to, they call it long voyage, or Dalne Plavanje, together with the aircraft carrier Kiev, to the Mediterranean. So we were then 7 months on the high seas in 1986, from summer to autumn.
And did you get any shore leave in the Mediterranean or not?
Yes, of course. Everybody told us that is a possibility. And yes, we did. In Tartus, Syria, for 4 hours during these 7 months.
So that was your only shore leave in 7 months?
Yes, my only leave in 7 months.
Wow, 4 hours.
Yeah. in city of Tartus, where there was absolutely nothing. And each of us got seven Syrian, I think, pounds. And so I bought a modern talking picture for my brother for that money. So there was absolutely nothing to do or nothing to see.
That's probably why they let you off, I suppose.
And there was always five people plus the politruk or somebody caring that you are not escaping. So it was always kind of under control. No, the 7 months I was on the ship, our task was in the group to follow the aircraft carriers. We did follow the aircraft carriers regularly. It was just after the bombing of Libya, as the American aircraft carriers were bombing Libya, 86.
Right, so your role was to monitor.
To monitor, count the planes, how many planes go and how many come back and what timing. Because that time, I think the Libya bombings, as at least that was told to us, that somebody was sleeping and didn't see that two planes left but didn't come back, and these two planes were then attacking Libya. So we had to follow. Our ship was following aircraft carriers, the carrier groups in the carrier group in the Mediterranean, and every time they went to the harbor, we were standing waiting on them, be it in Italy or somewhere else. So we were on the ship 7 months.
From what I understand is that there weren't many friendly harbours you could go into, so you had to carry out all the maintenance of the ship at
sea. Everything we need the same, and we got the supplies by different Russian supply ships, fueling in the move, all this. There was two harbors actually to go. Tartus was the one, but it was too small that time, so our ship was only on the anchor. And then Benghaz, which we didn't go first time. No, next time I went there, then we went to Benghaz. So during my 3 years and 3 months, I was happy to make two trips. So our ship was very excellent in that terms, that normally nobody was going twice in the row, but we had possibility to go 86 and 88 to the trip.
And so did you get ashore in 88 in Benghazi?
Yeah. Well, then we had Benghazi. I think we visited the Russian base there, not a military base, but they had kind of a civilian compound where we met first time civilian people in my time in the Navy. Some girls, so just to talk to them one evening, and then we visited factory of bicycles, I remember, and the university. So couple of our trips in Benghazi. But in the second time, and that's a very special story, then we went to, we took a trip over the ocean and were visiting Cuba, 1988. That was my more fun part of it, because I was already 3 years on the ship and last months to go, and you know everything. And then we were in Cienfuegos and Havana, 2 weeks. That was nice time, I would say.
did you get any more money to spend there or not?
No money. But we were paid well, because we were paid in the Soviet Union. There was kind of for civil merchant ships and for the Navy and some others, there was kind of a currency rubles, which were on the exchange rate on the black market, 1 to 25 rubles. So you could buy with them, they called bonds, and you could buy with them in the special shops where there were like Sony magnetophones and things like that. So therefore, we were pretty good paid. We couldn't use it. So I came home being immensely rich. because of this bones was a good part of it. Now I have actually positive memories of the second part of my service.
Because I guess Cuba was thought as a safe socialist country for you.
Yeah, so. Well, there was I remember why there was the reason why we went there is that Gorbachev was to be visiting Havana, Castro, Fidel that time. But then in Armenia, there was an earthquake. So we had to go to Leninakan earthquake. But we still were already on our way. So our task was to secure the air defense layer of his plane going to Havana. So we were able then to do the official visit, even though he didn't come. But we had loads of Gorbachev perestroika books to deliver them, to give them to Africans, and that was lots of fun. Personal contacts with Cubans were very, very short with the Cuban Navy, but not with civilians. But we were allowed to go to beach and had even one beer each, and so it was rather positive. And we saw first time pineapples, and there was lots of bananas and pineapples, and of course cigarettes, which was important at that time. Every sailor got a package of 20 blocks of cigarettes. So brought back it like a big parcel of 20 blocks each, 10 packs in it. A lot of cigarettes, Cuban, very strong cigarettes. We were very happy about. It's kind of her best thing to have.
Yeah, yeah. What was the name of your ship, Riha?
Zadorny, smiling ship or something. Zadorny was the name. Very well equipped frigate. We had four anti-submarine rockets. Which were launching, carrying submarine torpedoes. So there was a rocket which brought a torpedo to the place, and then some of them were said to be nuclear. We don't know about that, but at least there was a sign on it that we were not allowed to go close to it. And then we had the anti-submarine rocket launchers of 12 tubes, which was my responsibility. Then we had eight torpedoes. Then we had air defense rocket system and air defense gun systems and mines. So, and lots of submarine acoustic, what is the word for underwater radar?
Sonar.
Sonars, yes, right. Okay. So it was a very, very well equipped ship.
In the Mediterranean, how close were you to the NATO warships?
As close at this as it can be. the American helicopter pilots were throwing Marlboro cigarettes at us, 88. Then we were friends, you know. But we were very close, like two cables, which is 300 meters.
Wow, that is close. So, sorry, you very were saying close. The American helicopter pilots were dropping, what, presents to you?
Yeah, cigarettes.
Cigarettes.
it was fun. I mean, we were, the aircraft carriers, I remember it was Kennedy, it was Nimitz, and it was Kitty Hawk, these three aircraft carriers, which we were following day and night.
And I think there's a really interesting story in your later life. You're invited aboard, I think, Nimitz, was it?
I was invited on the George W. Bush, which was the same type as the Nimitz, exactly the same aircraft carrier. So the young lieutenant on board who was responsible to introduce the ship to the Army general was very surprised that I actually knew almost everything about the ship, where is what and how it works and all this because of my service in the Navy. And at that time, nothing has changed. I mean, there was much more clean and new, but the same system. So everything was in the same place, and, not that much differences. Yeah. Well, the other interesting story is that my colleague as the Chief of Defense of Norway, he was a submarine 85 to 88, and he was a submarine commander in Norwegian, northern Norwegian waters, Bergen, out of Bergen. So actually I was following the Norwegian submarines with my ship, and he was on that submarine. So he invited me to look at the world from his angle. So we went with the Norwegian submarine underwater in Barents Sea, and the kind of nice memory from that as well.
That must have been interesting. You prefer being above the sea rather than under the sea?
Absolutely, 100%. Even though the rough seas were pretty difficult, if you were. Know the storms in the Faroe Island, Iceland, Scotland, up in the north areas are very, very rough. And all the NATO ships or commercial ships would go hide in the harbors, but the Soviet Navy did not have any place to hide. So you had to spend like 6 days, 7 days, 9 days, the longest on the heavy storm. which really was something very special. That time we were afraid we will never come back, but today looking back, it was a nice time, interesting challenge.
Yeah, if you say so. If you say so. Did you participate in any exercises on the frigate, like live firing exercises?
Yes, we were. We had many exercises, a lot of exercises during the trips and in between. I mean, first we had our torpedo exercises where we were launching orange torpedo mock-ups, which we had to fish out of the Barents Sea in December.
Wow.
Because nobody wanted to give them to NATO. So you had to go on the rowing boat to the torpedo if you found it, and then bring it back to the ship. And I remember once, that is probably where I was closest to sunk with my boat. We were 8 people on the boat. It was not stormy, but it had some quite waves. And the 18-meter torpedo in hand with a rope, jumping out of water because it was like a buoy. And then Norwegian reconnaissance ship, White Moriarty, they called it, came between our ship and the boat to force us to release the torpedo. And so we were not able to go back on our ship. And it lasted days and weeks, but I think 4 hours or something.
Wow. So 4 hours in a rowing boat.
Yeah, and very, very cold weather, water, was uncomfortable, but we managed to get to the ship back. And I saw a submarine launch strategic missiles from out the water. Our ship was securing the area. So you saw the submarine from underwater, the missile launched coming out of the water and then heading to the horizon. That was very nice in the Barents Sea, Nordic night.
Yeah, that must have been really impressive.
Yeah. And the weather, of course, in there was like 30 minus.
Bit different from Cuba then.
Yeah, I had a temperature difference. We were in November 88, we were in Cuba, early November. And in December, we arrived in Murmansk. Cuba had 35 and Murmansk had 39 degrees Celsius. One had plus, the other had minus. So
wow.
I think the coldest thing was the Russian ships going to the narrow places. And there are lots of narrow fjords in Kola Peninsula. Going through these narrow places, you had to stand where the flag post is. You had to stand there and look whether something comes which you can't see from the bridge, like a security.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War, because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
And if the weather is minus 30, if the ship is doing 12 knots and because of the Gulf Stream, the water is not frozen, that means that it evaporates in the air and freezes in the air. So you have kind of a cold nails hitting you. So the temperature feels like minus 50. Then that is really something which is very, very cold. I mean, the coldest I've ever been in my life. And you had to stand there 3-4 minutes, and then somebody will come and exchange you, and then you can go back and warm up, and in 15 minutes you have to go back there. And you don't see anything anyway. It's dark and cold, and you cannot open your eyes, but you have to stay there because that's the manual.
Yeah, I can't imagine that cold. But that was a great description. When did your service in the Soviet military end?
30 December 1988.
When you returned home, had Estonia changed, or did you notice that it had changed?
Oh yeah, you cannot believe it, because in Estonia the real change took place in summer 1988, where the Singing Field Festival took place, and that is called Singing Revolution. After that, the blue, black and white was officially announced. Estonia has announced its independence, announced, not became, but has announced independence from the Soviet Union already 16 November 1988. So all this, what in the Western world is called fall of the wall, has already took place in Estonia in summer 1988. So as I left, it was Soviet Union poor, communist to the all ends. And during these 3 years, I had very few contacts with the world. Because of being on the seas, the mail came only every 3 or 4 months. My parents didn't know where I am. They just knew that I'm on the ship, but where address was Moscow 700. So kind of a tricky thing. And so I was shocked, literally. And they kept me until really 30 of December. If you remember, I went early October, I think, very early days of October. So I actually served 3 years and almost 3 months, which was the maximum you ever can serve in the Soviet conscription, from the first call to the last call.
When you returned to Estonia, did you, I'm presuming you straight away got involved in the independence movement?
Well, actually, I hated military that time, so I went to the university and studied history. But of course, 1990, I joined the paramilitary, that time underground movement of Defense League, which in Estonia is the National Guard, still existing and very popular. Yes, I joined the anti-Soviet movement in 1990. But 1 year, 89 to 90, I just was happy to be back home as a young man. So I actually spent my 20th birthday in Cuba. So, or way to Cuba, actually. Not in Cuba, but way to Cuba. On the way to Cuba.
Yeah.
Yeah, so not fun. But one thing I want to say is, and there's lots of stories of negative stories about the Soviet service. On the ship, actually, if you were working hard, and if you were not sleeping in your duty, then there was no kind of pushing or pulling for the young people. Because everybody was relying on the other one. Every person had its task. And no difference if you were officer or conscript. If you slept on duty, you were bullied. Commander bullied the lieutenant, young lieutenant, the same way as we bullied somebody who didn't do the job properly. But there was no kind of a fights or something like that, even between the nations. Because on the ship, 100 people with officers together, you rely on each other. On the stormy weather, there's no question, you have to rely on everybody. And therefore, I didn't see that. And we were very well fed. We had five times a day food, very clean, very professionally cooked, and very, very good. And that is, again, a reason. If the cook didn't cook well, so then the crew went to him and asked what's happened, and then he cooked well again.
No, I guess it's, yeah, because you are, you know, you've got a common enemy in terms of the weather.
Yeah.
When you're on a, when you're
weather
on a
and sea and everything, and then you have to just, that's just how it was.
Can I ask you a few bits about independence? Because I'm interested to hear your experience of that period. Can you remember when you heard about the coup in Moscow? What was your reaction to that?
Okay. Well, I was a student. I was a member of Defense League. But that was, we didn't have that many trainings that time. We just were officially members, but not that many. And I was in my university, practicum in Tartu. But the morning putsch happened, I collected 30 students. We armed ourselves with Molotov cocktails, hijacked a bus from the street, asked him to go to Tallinn, and then we were on the barricades by the radio station, or central radio and television station, on the barricades during the whole putsch. So I was, and as the Russians arrived from Pskov on the infantry fighting vehicles, passing us by a couple of meters, I was on the barricades together with my student friends.
Estonia was lucky in terms of there wasn't any bloodshed.
Yeah, it was close. I mean, in Lithuania and Latvia it was. In Estonia it wasn't, just because the local military commander, Russian military commander, was a sensible person. And that is not about, he got an order, but he didn't follow the order. And in Lithuania, it was vice versa. There was an idiot division commander, and therefore there were people killed. In Estonia, there wasn't, and there were no people killed. But it was close. I mean, they were like driving by 30 meters less. And if somebody would have thrown a Molotov cocktail or something would have happened, that would have been a bloodbath. But it didn't. But it was very close, very close.
Because Estonia declared full independence during the coup, didn't it?
Yes, 20 August, 11:50-something p.m.
And you can remember the moment you heard?
Yeah, of course, yeah. We were all listening to radio at that time, everybody. We were on the barricades, the Russians were there, but then the announcement came that the coup d'etat fall apart in Moscow, and then the Russians left. And then we were independent and penniless.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, how does a country suddenly switch from being part of the Soviet Union to being independent? I mean, you know, because the currency is still ruble, police, taxes, and all that sort of thing. How does that?
It took a certain, but in 8 months' time, or I mean, actually in a year time, we had an election. In a year, less than a year, we had the currency changed. against every IMF advice or every mature European democracy advice, our government decided to have own currency, which really nobody thought we would manage. Every Estonian started with 1,500 rubles, were exchanged to 150 kronas, so 10 euros. Every Estonian started with 10 euros.
So could people only exchange 1,500 rubles? Was that the limit that they could change?
Yes, yes.
So the whole country
started with zero.
Wow, I hadn't realized that. So what happened to the rest of their rubles? What happened to those?
They were sold to Chechens. It came out 10 years later, but the government did sell them to Chechen Republic, Johar Dudayev, who was actually a military commander in Estonia during the coup d'etat. Johar Dudayev was their Air Force base commander in one of the cities, and he was very nationalistic already and very supportive to Estonian independence at that time. And so they sold the rubles to the Chechen Republic before the Chechen War. And yes, and then of course the privatization took part very quickly. The prime minister was 32, the minister of foreign affairs was 27, and these young boys, they just were mad enough to do very quick decisions to privatize the whole economy to 95%. Everybody got back their family's property from 1940.
Yeah.
If there was somebody to get that, and every Estonian got vouchers for the years you lived in Soviet Union, so you could privatize your flat, your house, your property. So I think these very quick changes of the economy made it happen that we were very successful very quickly.
The Soviet army remained in Estonia till 1994. Did they just stay in their barracks?
Yeah, well, that was because I then joined the Estonian armed forces. I was the first in the first officers course, which lasted 1.5 months from December 91 to January 92. Then I was the first of two company commanders. And 6 months later, I was XO of the battalion of 500 conscripts with 1.5 months army education. And my naval education didn't help that much at that time. And then 1992, in spring, we were taking over the Russian bases where the Russian colonels were still in. So a young second lieutenant, me, and the colonel from the other side, we were arguing about how to take over the bases. I mean, it was fun. Lots of fun.
So you were having to negotiate as a second lieutenant with a Soviet colonel as to what they were going to leave behind.
And they didn't leave anything. They just left empty rooms. They even took their toilets with them or sold them or whatever. So there was a disaster which we took over. There was nothing to be used. So we were living. I was living in my office on the table. I had a mattress under the table. So in the daytime, I used it as an office table, and in the nighttime I slept on my table. There were lots of mad things we did that first years. But right now, one of my conscripts is our chief of staff, so it's okay. We did well.
That's incredible. Well, it's an incredible, right? Because you know, you were chief of defense 2011 to 2018.
Yeah.
So you know, that's quite a quick progression through through the ranks. Really.
Yeah, but if your army has, well, I was the only serving military, as I was chief of defense, the longest serving military, because I was from the first day of the Estonian reestablishing the Estonian army. Maybe Air Force came later.
You said there was a significant Russian population in Estonia. Did a lot of them leave to go to the Soviet Union, or did they take Estonian citizenship?
Well, no, not that many left. The armed forces left, but the rest of people left, stayed in Estonia. And if you could choose whether you go to Russia or be in a European country, you would rather stay in a European country. That's easy to decide. One-third of them took Estonian citizenship. One-third of them have Russian citizenship, and one-third of them are stateless. They don't have citizenship. They have so-called gray passports. They have permission, permit to live in Estonia, but they don't have possibility to vote on the parliamentary election. Every other right they have, but they are not able to vote on the parliamentary election. They can vote on the local election and so on, but not in the parliamentary election. But they are there. But they speak. They are kind of assimilated or integrated, so there's no problem.
Did your experience in the Soviet military help you with your newer military career in any way?
No.
Did it not give you any insights into the Soviet or Russian mentality?
Of course, that is something, and of course the knowledge of the language and all this. People ask whether I speak Russian. They say I had an intensive practice, 3 years and 3 months on the ship on Krima. I mean, the mentality, but I knew it before and already from my life. And of course, to understand the Russian mentality, that is, and I've lived with them long enough, and not only Russians, but from the whole different Soviet republics. Yes, but really from the tactics and military and that side, not at all. One thing which people don't imagine is that the 18-year-old boy is taken out of the mother's bed and sent to Vladivostok, Severomorsk, the end of the world. I mean, I had friends who were serving next to Mongolia or even Mongolia. I had friends who were serving in the middle of Russia, not speaking a language at all. And of course, you mentioned that the bullying or the beating ups were normal that time in the army units, and you had to spend there 2 years. That is, people mature during this time. They came back all men, all of
them. There's further information such as photos and videos in our episode notes, which will show as a link in your podcast app. Now, this show wouldn't exist without our generous Patreons, so I want to thank one and all of them for their support. You can very easily become a Patreon by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. And you can also join our Facebook group where listeners just like you continue the Cold War conversation. Thanks very much for listening. It is really appreciated. Goodbye. not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.